Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn. You tell me.
Hi, this is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in therapy and research. We think of anger as a bad thing, but anger is actually kind of like a violin. Play a violin really badly as a novice, and it's like scraping your fingernails on the blackboard of somebody's psyche. But learn how to use it, and you can, if not mesmerize an audience, at least maybe move them in the way you want. So whether you're an anger venter or an anger withholder or something in between, tonight's show is for you. My guest tonight, therapist Dr. Andrea Brandt, will help you understand why anger can actually be a good thing. You just need the chops to use it to your benefit. Her book we'll be discussing tonight is Mindful Anger, A Pathway to Emotional Freedom. So don't get mad, not until you know how to do it right. Stick with us and learn how to use your anger judiciously, which can lead to cascading positive benefits in every area of your life. Hello, Andrea.
Hi, Amy. How are you?
Well, great, because I love this subject. And one thing I really loved about your book is that you point out that your goal is not to help people get rid of their anger, but to handle it better, and that this really has so many positive effects just in every area, relationships, business. And so people, what do we do wrong in terms of our behavior and thinking about anger?
Well, we've been brought up since childhood to really see anger as a bad emotion, that if somebody's angry, somebody's going to get hurt. And it doesn't have to be that way. So we're promoted to deny the anger, suppress it, make it go away at whatever cost. And so when we feel it, it scares us, because we don't have any tools really on how to deal with it. So we get reactive, or we dump it, as you said, or we withhold it. And these are not appropriate, healthy ways of dealing with anger.
And now, if you can speak a little bit more into your phone, your parents repressed their anger, you say, and discouraged you from expressing and releasing your own anger. And you say that this actually was a very abusive environment, one that's, it's harder to see this abuse than hitting or slapping, but you say it's actually just as devastating.
Absolutely. Even if the anger is hidden or the messages are implicit rather than explicit, it's just as devastating for the person to learn how to withhold the anger, because now the anger is eating you up from the inside out.
And you say a lot of what precedes anger is the inability to be honest, which makes sense with what you just said. You know, few people have grown up in a very emotionally safe environment, a place where they could be truthful about their feelings. And so tell us a little bit about that, the inability to be honest.
Well, if parents have difficulty with their own anger, they certainly don't want to hear about yours. So we learn how to lie. We learn how to, you know, get sneaky and say things that perhaps we know that our parents will be upset with us for. But because more than anything, we want their love and approval. Well, if we want their love and approval and we've gotten the message that anger isn't going to get it for us, we're not going to be upfront with it.
Now, I mentioned the different anger styles in my intro, and I want to talk about those. So you write about the dumper venter and then the withholder suppressor, and then you add that there's a sort of in-between style, and we'll get to that too. But first, tell us about the dumper venter style of anger, which I think we know what it is, but I'd like to hear you talk about it.
Okay. The dumper is someone who never puts a lid on it. They scream, they pace, they shove, they punch, they just, they're like a tornado on an otherwise sunny day. They display anger, and sometimes it's retaliatory. The withholder, on the other hand.
Oh, wait, we're gonna get to the withholder. But when you say retaliatory, just explain that.
Well, it's like we're hardwired as children that when somebody hurts us, we want to hurt them back. And so if we get arrested at that young age, we'll still want to do that as adults. You hurt me, you got angry at me, you yelled at me, I'm going to yell at you too, only I'm going to yell louder.
And so you're saying these patterns, do these all our anger patterns start in our childhood, do you think?
I believe so. Recently on my blog, someone was trying to tell me it started in school. But I think it starts long before school. The interesting thing, Amy, is when we're born and we come out of the womb and they hold us upside down or right side up, whatever, and they give us a swat on our butt, we start screaming and crying. And the interesting thing is it brings everybody toward us. It's like God's first gift to us because it gets our needs met. You know, those screams at that very, very infant stage age say, feed me, clothe me, hold me, love me. And we're all there trying to take care of the infant. But that changes. And it no longer stays that way, because I guarantee you if people acted like that today, people would go running for the hills.
Right. Apparently, speaking of running for the hills, I don't want people to do that from the show. So I actually, Greg said that I made a mistake telling you to be closer to the mic. So can you just back off it a little bit? But you can just project from a little bit back from your phone. So,
okay.
Sorry about that. So you say, this is very interesting to me, that if you could talk to dumpers about what's happening as they're dumping, they might tell you that they become overwhelmed by uncomfortable feelings and are compelled
right.
to vent their anger.
The dumpers are not able to tolerate the discomfort of their anger. It feels so bad. Or the anxiety that might precede the anger. They cannot tolerate it, so they need to discharge it, however they do that.
But I've read that this sort of discharging of anger, that it's a myth, this idea, the catharsis theory, that you just vent your anger and it'll be gone, and that we now know that there's this whole amygdala reaction that goes on where you
right.
get hotter and hotter, all these chemicals coursing around. And so this is not what you're talking about when you're talking about healthy anger, even though withholding is another problem that we're going to get to.
Right. I am not talking about discharging it. Discharging does not help the person deal with their anger. In fact, all our feelings have wisdom in them, whether it's anger or love or fear or sadness. And if we just dump it or discharge it, we miss all of that.
This is a very important point you make in your book, and I'm talking with Dr. Andrea Brandt. Her book is Mindful Anger, A Pathway to Emotional Freedom. It's very good. The wisdom of our feelings. When we are angry, there's a message being sent to us. And talk a little bit about that, the wisdom of our anger.
Well, feelings are energy, and they have lots of information for us. But because we were brought up in a society that goes for pleasure and not pain, that it's almost antithetical to ask someone to sit with their feelings and get the information that the feelings are holding for them. Meaning, if you're angry, there's a reason you're angry. And if you don't know what it is or how angry you really are or what you're really angry about, if you sit with that anger rather than discharging it and be present with it, your body will tell you what that anger is about. So that's what I'm referring to when I say wisdom, because it's in, most people go through life, Amy, in a trance. And what I'm saying is when you go through life in a trance, you're missing the information that your body can tell you.
What I got from that, actually, I wrote the note to myself, get to the point of articulate anger. And this is something that, you know, comes with the slow down advice that you give. But I want to get into the withholder suppressor a little bit. Tell us a little bit about the withholder suppressor style of being angry.
Well, the withholder is somebody who kind of detaches from their anger. Their anger is outside of their conscious awareness. They don't recognize it. They suppress it. Those people are many times passive-aggressive because they've never been given permission to be angry. So if their anger comes out at all, it's not going to be direct. And they'll substitute other feelings. They'll project their anger, but they won't be direct with it. In fact, they'll try to, like, leave their bodies in order to not feel it.
And you give some examples of typical things an anger withholder does, and some of these, you know, are pretty well-known to us, become buried in work or projects and eat way too much and get absorbed in TV shows. But some of the most interesting ones to me, and I'll read them from your book, are take on too much responsibility for other people's problems, which is a great way to feel burdened. It's like, go like Jesus. Criticize yourself or feel guilty instead of experiencing anger. Become passive about pursuing goals or making other life improvements. There's drinking, substance abuse, and then smother feelings with depression. And, you know, it really is such an unhealthy way to be either withholder or eventer, but it seems to me, especially the withholding, as you experienced as a child, and actually as I experienced, it's sort of eating yourself from within.
Yes, it is. You're eating yourself from the inside out. And the people will do anything to avoid confronting their anger.
Yeah, it's really, really
it's
unhealthy.
Scary.
And you say it helps people to figure out which style they are, a dumper or a withholder. And it doesn't seem, you know, to me, you think about that, oh, that's not that hard to do. But actually, you say something very interesting, that you need to be objective enough to see all the results of your anger style. This means not only the cost, but the accomplishments or gifts. So that they're going to be things, there's a reason people have this as their strategy. It's good for them in some way. So they have to figure that out, you say.
Yes, they do have to figure it out because when you started the show, you made reference to the fact that anger is good, and it is, and it has a lot of positive qualities to it. So many times it's appropriate to be out there with your anger. I don't mean dumping or discharging, but I mean direct with it. And there are times when it's important to withhold it because maybe you're at work and it's not appropriate to put it out to this particular person at this particular time. But basically what I'm saying is you need to know the impact of your anger on yourself and on others.
I really think that's an important message. So if you understand your anger, you can be judicious about expressing it because it's not just, okay, I was a withholder, now I'm going to be a dumper. It's that you're judicious about how you express your anger, how you process it, and it's more than just changing style. It's really an internal thing, and self-knowledge is really involved in this.
It's a lot of self-awareness, which is where, when I talk about mindfulness, that's the sole purpose.
Yeah, and we will get to that. I wrote about mindfulness meditation in my column, and this is such an excellent strategy to help people to get in touch with what their style is, to manage their anger better. But I just wanted to emphasize again, I really think it's important the way you say anger is good, and that you talk about that. Just emphasize that again about how it's a spotlight for what's going on in your life.
Yes, it is, because anger can strengthen relationships. It tells us when something is wrong. It sparks our motivation, our focus. It gives us a spike of self-confidence. It's got all kinds of wonderful things, qualities to it, and one of them is it brings intimacy to relationships, which most people don't think of, because most people were not brought up with the fact that anger and love could exist in the same relationship.
Can you give us an example of that, about how anger can improve a relationship? Because we don't think of it that way.
I know. Well, you know, if I'm upset with my husband and I can feel it in my body gurgling around, because I, you know, I know where I feel my anger, which is in my chest area, and I need to say something to him, I might say, because I know that if I don't say something, I'm going to create distance and I'm going to be upset and angry, ultimately. So I might say something to him like, I need to talk to you about something. It's difficult for me to say or bring up, and it might be difficult for you to hear. Is now a good time? So I've kind of made a bridge there of saying, this is not going to be an easy conversation. Are you prepared for this? And if he is, I can then tell him what I'm upset about, and he can respond, and we can go back and forth how many times we need to. But at the end of that, we're going to feel closer. Not that he was feeling angry, but I was. But I'm no longer going to be feeling angry if I feel that he's heard me and has acknowledged me. He doesn't have to agree with me. But if just listening to me is
right.
Wonderful.
Yeah, this is an important point you make. People don't really understand. They don't have to agree. They just
right.
have to be sincere in listening and really hear
right.
you. It's really too much to expect people to always agree with you, especially there are those points that couples will never agree on. And I think
right.
that's something that people really need to recognize, that without this, the problem is just submerged, and it festers, and people run around, you know, you snap at someone, not because they did something terrible with the coffee mug, but because you're still mad about that thing that you never brought to the surface.
Exactly. Exactly. And it'll come out when you least expect it at some other time, and then you're both in trouble.
Absolutely. This is Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is therapist Dr. Andrea Brandt, and her book, which is excellent, that we're discussing is Mindful Anger, A Pathway to Emotional Freedom. We're going to get to mindfulness meditation, and believe me, everybody who listens to the show knows I am the least yoga woo-woo person out there, but I read all this research on mindfulness meditation, and it's good. It really improves your life in many, many ways. You don't have to sit and do it in yoga pants and, you know, go to yoga studio or anything, and it really makes a difference in making you able to deal with your feelings. So tell us a little bit about what mindfulness is.
Mindfulness is the state of mind in which we intentionally focus on ourselves in the present and just watch the present evolve. We observe our thoughts and feelings, memories, the environment, but we do not judge them. We do
and
not
now,
concern ourselves with the past or the future. The goal of mindfulness is simply and purely to live in the present moment without being distracted or preoccupied with anything else. It's
and
kind
now,
of waking up and being aware of what is going on with you. It's the opposite of what I said before, that most people live in a trance.
Yes, and I just wanted to give people a sense of how this works. And I read, for this column I wrote, the research of Jon Kabat-Zinn and
right.
his colleagues. And it can be as simple as just lying down and observing your bodily sensations, thinking, okay, there are my toes, I feel my toes, I feel my knees. And it helps you detach from the sort of clutching fears and things and not be so... stuck in your feelings, so you can maybe see them.
Exactly. You can become a witness. You know, you're just observing your internal experience.
And so... Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say... And you're becoming a witness to what is going on with you. And it's a lot of information that we bypass unless we slow down and take this time.
Yeah, that's very important. So slowing down, I think this is important to note, slowing down allows you to be a witness to what's going on in your life. And if you think about that, I'm thinking about when you're in an argument with somebody or just even a discussion,
mm-hmm.
your thoughts are flying by so fast, and maybe you're paying attention to things in the environment. As you said, we are not really good at being singularly focused. And so it's really hard to take the wise approach. And so this slowing down, talk about how that helps when you're back in that situation. How does that transform you, and how long does it take to transform yourself? Because we're American, we want it instantly.
I know.
Or sort of instantly,
especially
within
with
reason.
Technology now. You know, one of the metaphors I use is the snow globe. If everybody knows what a snow globe is, if you shake up that snow globe and you see all those flakes moving around, that's pretty much what our brain is as we go through life on a daily basis. But if you're doing mindfulness, instead of the blizzard of snowflakes, which are all the thoughts and flashes of memory and things you're reminding yourself going through your consciousness. And you just take that present moment and close your eyes for a moment and imagine the snowfall slowly, gently, flowing gently to a little flurry of flakes and the last of them settling to the ground. Imagine the stillness and the beauty at the end of that fresh snowfall. That's what happens. That's the gift of mindfulness. And if you practice it 10 minutes, 15 minutes a day, 3-4 times a week, you will see amazing improvement. It's like less is more. You get, people think, oh, but I won't remember, I won't get everything done. That's not true. You'll get more done because you will be aligned with yourself, your feelings, your sensations, and what your needs are.
Yeah, it's that slowing down. It does sound counterintuitive, but I do this for, I'll do it for a few weeks and then I'll sort of not do it for a few weeks. And I find it makes me better. It makes me more balanced. And I'm being speedy is one of my problems. And it makes me a little bit more able to slow down. And so to be wiser, it really, you're much more efficient if you're wise than if you're all hot-headed. It just makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely. And when you say, I can relate to you when you said, you know, you're usually speedy. Speedy gives us the illusion that we're accomplishing more.
Yeah, it's the chicken with the head cut off also is another way of saying that. You know, and it's, I think that it's good to be able to laugh at your foibles because then you can admit them and change them. And that's a big thing that you say we need to get into what our style is, and that's part of what mindfulness is helpful for, You say it can let you discover what's beneath your reactions to situations such as anger, can get you in touch with the charge beneath your anger, which may come in part from experience in the past, as you were saying before.
Right, right. And the truth is, it's what is under the anger. Why are you so angry? You know? And if you slow down and do some mindfulness, you'll find out what is really bothering you.
And part of the reason you say that this is important to do is that a lot of times the stuff that is really bothering us isn't rational, isn't reasonable. And we'll get into a bit of that about how our beliefs play a role in anger. But I just wanted to stay on mindfulness a little more because you talk about, you know, it sounds a little bit, how do I do this? But that's why I described it, because it really is that simple. I didn't take a class. I hate yoga classes. I can't remember which one's my left arm. It's embarrassing. but you give these great little techniques, some exercises. I love this. To mindfully eat an orange. And this is so wonderful because we often don't even taste our food. We're just gobbling it down, you know, and this is about savoring the moment, which it sounds airy-fairy, but it's really a much more enjoyable way to live.
You know, Amy, when you're doing mindfulness, there's no multitasking. You can't eat in front of the television. And a lot of families do that.
And you talk about also another exercise is mindfulness of your environment, mindfulness of your thoughts and feelings. And there is just this study that somebody did where people could be, they could choose to have an electric shock or be in a room alone with themselves. And I don't know if the students were trying to, because they always test on students, trying to prank the researchers or something, or if it has to do with how attached people are. They're so in the habit of consulting their electronic binky every 3 minutes that maybe they just aren't used to that enough. But the thing about mindfulness of your environment, your thoughts and feelings, maybe people need to spend more time alone in a room.
Oh, I think they do. Just spend time alone and see, just be aware of what happens to you. Maybe you feel stuck. Well, how does stuck feel? Or you feel alone. How does it feel to be alone?
And I was just going to say, just that one of the things that's so freeing about this sort of meditation where you're just even, you don't have to think about your life. You can just focus on what are my bodily feelings, you know, that this is very, very freeing. You don't have to, it's a way to get into this where you can sort of train yourself to do this, where it's not scary. You don't have to think, well, what do I think about that? Or it's the non-judgmentalness that makes it so effective in helping you slow down.
Absolutely. And one of the other tips I always tell people is, especially if they're just starting to use mindfulness, because there's all kinds of reasons people think they can't do it, but if you're trying to do it and your mind wanders, to other thoughts of tomorrow or your friend or what one of your kids or whatever, just to say the word wandering and bring yourself back to the moment, because that's not a punishing way of saying it when you use ing on the end of the word wander.
You also have this quote, which I really liked, that you talk about some of the common obstacles in practicing mindfulness, and one of them is you can't get into it, which you're talking about now. You say, try exploring your lack of response as an inner experience. And it's so great to not, this idea of don't judge yourself. Okay, your mind's wandering. We're human. This is normal. My mind is like,
exactly.
I have ADHD. I have like 16 squirrels in my head all going 16 directions. And actually, the most helpful thing about getting the diagnosis was realizing, oh, this is a thing. Okay, I'm not, I shouldn't be ashamed about this. There's no need to, or I shouldn't say shouldn't. There's no need to be ashamed. This is a feature of my brain. Some good features, some less good for certain things. And so, okay, your mind wanders. This is a facet of you. Observe it non-judgmentally, and then you can stand back better in these situations, these heated situations, and say, okay, you know, I'm a little hurty and he's a little woundy and, you know, this is normal, and not be, not sort of, you know, fly off the diving board over it.
Exactly. You do not have to feel ashamed at all. You just have to bring yourself back to the moment and just name it for what it is. Your mind wandered. Big deal.
Yeah. And now, do you do this mindfulness meditation daily?
I try to do it daily, and I try to do it at the end of my day because I need to, like, bring myself down and calm myself. So I'll stay in my office and sit in a chair or lay down on the couch. And but sometimes, minimum, I'll do it 3 times a week.
I'm really glad you told me that about the end of the day, because in that, what I would do is I do it at dumb time, middle of the day, when I'm thinking, oh, my God, can I get another hour of writing in? I'm going to be too tired. And
right.
This sounds, the way you're doing it, it sounds kind of psychologically like smoking a cigarette, you know, like people go out
yeah.
and they, you know, take some drugs. I know nicotine's actually an excitant, but it just, the way you're doing it, it sounds like that to me, that you're sort of, okay, now it's my break before I continue the rest of my day, to sort of
exactly.
reflect in some way.
Yeah, and it kind of is a break between me and whatever I'm doing in the evening, you know, so I'm more present for the evening.
Yeah, I think that's a really, I'm gonna start doing this at the end of the day, and maybe I can stick to it better that way. This is Amy
right.
Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is therapist Dr. Andrea Brandt. Her book, very practical, excellent, is Mindful Anger, A Pathway to Emotional Freedom. Now, here's a sort of advanced anger question. I had an issue with a neighbor that I was very close with. And I made this mistake. I learned how to deal with my anger after being from that family where it's a withholding thing. And so
sure.
I just expressed the problem. They had done something, and I thought, well, that's really rude. I felt really stomped on. And what was so amazing, I put this in a letter just because I thought, well, I'm going to tell you these things so they can be out there and I'm not festering over them, you know, and then we can solve it. And they were so freaked out that I told them these things. You know, and it sort of messed up our relationship. I did it so we could correct
wow.
the bad feeling, because I feel people apologize to me. They say things to me on the internet and they apologize, and it's just over. A neighbor apologized to me, another neighbor. He had said something really rude to me and came over and apologized. And I said, I really admire you for that. And we just really, I mean, totally at that moment started anew. So what do you do when you've worked on your anger and you try to express it in a healthy way to somebody who's not really there yet?
Oh, well, you know, if they're not there, there's nothing I can do about that. I need to just be responsible for my part and my anger and say it in an assertive way, you know, and not have an expectation that they're necessarily going to get it, because they might not get it. I had this with one of my stepkids about a year ago. He was unwilling to hear what I had to say. And I said, okay, you're unwilling to hear me. I'm not going to expect you to validate me or acknowledge me, but I need to say and take responsibility for what I did. And if you do take responsibility for your anger at me, that's up to you. However, I'm aware that in the interim, last year to this year, I watch how much I give these people now. Because if I keep giving and giving, and they're not able to take responsibility for their feelings with me, then it's a black hole. I'm not getting anything back.
Yeah, that's very important, to be judicious, to not be a victim. And this is what I realized from these people, just that, okay, well, they don't really have the same way of dealing with things. That's really a shame. I was very fond of them. And
it is. It's disappointing, Amy.
It is. And to acknowledge a disappointment, we talked a little bit before the show about Albert Ellis, who was sort of a mentor to me.
Right.
He's the late founder of Rational Emotive Behavior Therapy. And you write, too, about how beliefs, especially irrational beliefs, play a role in anger. And
right.
Ellis, he was a big fan of the Stoic philosopher Epictetus, who said, it is not events that disturb us, but the views we take of them. And what you describe, your reaction, and that's like the PhD anger dealing that you're doing, you know, that was an example of that saying, okay, here's how you're behaving. You're kind of a jerk, I think, but I can't change that, but I'm going to tell you how I feel so I am and behave a little differently so I'm not victimized. So that's a healthy way. That's healthy
right.
use of anger.
Yes, it is, because I don't want to feel badly about myself. And time allows me to get more clarity on who these people are, and that's okay. I don't have to sit in judgment, but I also don't have to, you know, keep throwing myself and all my wisdom at people who really don't want it.
Right. And you just said something very important. Time provides clarity. And something I've learned is that you don't have to have an argument or a discussion on somebody else's timetable. And one of the things I've learned to
right.
say is, I don't know. I'm not ready to talk about this now. And as a person who has, it's actually that you don't have too little attention, it's that you have too much with ADHD, that I can't
yes.
pay attention right now. And so articulating those things, that makes your relationships better because you don't do things when you're unprepared for them. And you accept that maybe you need time to prepare. It's like a test. It's a life test.
And you deserve to take care of yourself in that way. Because it's what we said before, taking responsibility for what you can deal with and want to deal with.
Yes, absolutely, that you are in charge. And we'll get into your work on assertiveness, where you talk about assertiveness being healthy anger. But I want to get back to Albert Ellis a little bit.
Right.
You lay out Ellis's, he called them the ABCs for solving emotional problems. Now, A is the activating event, the
right.
thing that happens. B is your beliefs, what you think. And C is the consequences or what happens. And you, so I'm going to quote you. You say, basically, when a situation occurs, A, your beliefs and thoughts about the situation produce B, your emotions, and C, your reactions. But you note that the way we respond emotionally to an individual situation is a choice, like the choice you made. But the problem is when yours was a conscious choice, if we haven't worked out how to deal with our anger, it's often an unconscious choice, and that's what gets us into trouble.
Right. It does. It's the things that get in our way are we make assumptions, something happens, we see it in a certain way, and we develop a feeling about it without checking it out with the other person. We make assumptions about what the other person's behavior meant, and what they're saying about us. And we need to check out what the timeline is. Is this from the present or from the past?
Go ahead, sorry. The things you're saying that we just, this is where this hot-headedness, which I contend to, you know, that it really gets us in trouble because it's like we're inventing all of this stuff, and you say this thing in the book, we often bring the past into the present, and especially the
right.
stuff about how we grew up, how we dealt with anger, what it meant, what some behavior meant, you know, 20 years ago, and that person,
exactly.
their behavior may be totally different based on totally different reasons, and they may not even mean to offend where you feel maybe hurt and disrespected, which you say is a big source of anger for us, of course.
Yes, disrespect and hurt. Yeah, definitely a big source of anger. But people, you know, have judgments. They go to assumptions and judgments and irrational thinking unrealistic expectations. They expect people to mind read them. So these are all things that end up making the person angry. It's the consequence.
I'm going to give an example of one of these. I'm a writer, and a lot of my friends are, and then I have young writer friends who are trying to get agents or sell their first piece of work, and there's one area that people really have unrealistic expectations, and on both sides is the writer and the person who's going to read their work, whether it's an agent or a friend. I always tell writers, it takes people longer to read your stuff than anybody ever thinks. My agent,
right,
who's a great person, she was pregnant, and she's so great. I wanted her to represent me. I didn't care if she was going to be gone for 5 months before my book was going to go out. And so she said she'd read my proposal in November, but she just, I mean, I know she must have been like, she works really hard, working 20 hours a day. She just didn't get to it. And I understood this because I understood this luckily beforehand, that this is just how humans are. And so
right,
I took that time, because I wasn't all angry, I thought, well, how do I make this work for me? So I took the time from November to March when she came back, and I worked and worked and really made my book proposal great. So instead of spending whatever 5 months being all butthurt, as they say, I spent it productively because I didn't have that irrational idea, the unrealistic expectations.
Right.
So how do you advise that people get in the habit of thinking more rationally, of taking a sort of more balanced approach without being distorted and thinking, you know, giving people the benefit of the doubt when they don't really deserve it?
Well, they kind of need to ask themselves some questions, you know, would be helpful. Does this, whatever the situation, remind me of something or someone? Can I remember a time when I felt like this before? We need to check out if we're overreacting in the present. Is there a clue to that, that there's some kind of unresolved issue lurking around? And, you know, people, there are people that fall into the trap of perfectionism. And those are people that only see flaws. And they never, that's all they look for, because they need to know what to make right. And they have an unrealistic expectation. Because, and their needs are going to be unmet because there's no such thing as perfectionism. There's excellence. You can strive for excellence. But you can't just assume or expect without checking within yourself about where this feeling, or sit with it mindfully and check in with where this feeling is really coming from.
So mindfulness can help you with to get rid of that perfectionistic tendency, which
yes,
is irrational. How
yes,
does it help?
It helps because if you're being mindful, you have more, you have a space between the feeling and your reaction. And in that space, you will have a sense of clarity, and you don't have to get reactive.
Yeah, I think that that's very important. To that space, that is what I experienced from mindfulness meditation. I want to just get back to, you talked about how angry behavior is learned at home, how we deal with anger, how we handle it, and you say that this comes, it starts in two main ways. We observe our parents and caregivers displaying anger, and then there are these explicit and implicit messages our parents send us when our childhood
right,
anger shows up. And you get into this term from Dr. Donald Winnicott, who is a pediatrician and psychoanalyst.
Self.
Right,
mm-hmm.
The false self. This is the person we think our parents and other important people in our lives will accept and love. And you say that the problem with creating our false self is that the more we do that, that we cut off our true feelings, the less able we are to get in touch with them.
That's true. But, you know, the false self is really a very clever adaptation when we're young. Because, as I said, we want so much to be loved, to love and to be loved by our parents and to get their approval. But when we know that there are certain behaviors and feelings that will not get their approval, we cut off those feelings. We cut ourselves off from those feelings. We dissociate. We compartmentalize them. We repress them. We push them down until they are buried. But they're never gone. Out of sight is never out of mind. But we do begin to live apart from those feelings, and we negate them anytime we think they may, you know, not get us the approval that we crave. So the false self is the person we think our parents and other important people will accept and love. And only until someone in your adult life says, wow, I don't quite see you that way. I remember years ago someone saying, oh, I remember when you were a kid, you were always so shy. Well, there's nothing really shy about me unless I get in such a foreign place that I have to size it up first before I come out. But I'm not really shy. So it was kind of a red light signal for me that said, I wonder what that's about. Or my mother used to say to me, oh, don't ever lose your sense of humor. And I found myself afraid to not laugh when someone thought they were being funny, because that was part of my false self. I could be the clown or I could be the smart one. But I was not feeling my feelings. I was just playing a role. And that's what people do.
I found this very scary. I didn't have friends, and so I was kind of a suck-up in my early 20s, and I worked my way through that, and now I'm sort of disagreeable for the greater good. As I describe, I have a new book out, Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say Fuck, and I say that.
I love that title, by the way.
Thank you. So that was, actually, I consider it my greatest accomplishment to become this person who has no problem being disagreeable, but it was very scary in my early 20s when really, I mean, I couldn't find my opinion with the search party and dogs because I had so lost it. I was like a censor for what I thought other people wanted me to say. And this is the worst way to find respect or happiness or friends or anything. And so I didn't have mindfulness meditation, but I know, and I read this in your book, how helpful that is for people to get in touch with their thoughts, because if you slow down the world like that, and you just even start with feeling your knee, you have to start somewhere, and people don't realize that. They want to be all solved right away, that, okay, you're going to lie down today, and you're going to feel your knee. You're really going to feel your knee, and that is a stepping stone. If you do this daily, like you're saying, or at least, like, you know, 3 times a week, I mean, that's a way to get there.
Absolutely.
And I do think we have this thing where we expect things to be instant, and I think it is really important to recognize that we have to do things step by step like that, and just to look for these little, you know, look a week later, or my friend Mary Dan Eads, who's a doctor, has been on the show talking about low carb. She likes the 3 weeks as a benchmark, because that doesn't sound like a month. You know, you can do something for 3 weeks. Doesn't sound terrible. You're going to have change at that point, you know, 21
Absolutely.
Days.
No, I agree with you 100%.
And you write about also in the same chapter where you write about Donald Winnicott, you talk about how victimhood thinking arises, that when you're disempowered, you feel like a victim, and it has this effect of causing a ton of anger.
Oh, yes. Victims are like martyrs. They're the people with the most anger, because everybody else gets their needs met but them. And it's hard for victims to give up their role, because they get people to take care of them. It's fascinating. And they don't recognize how angry they are. So it causes, as you said, a ton of anger. And we don't see that when we're victims, we don't see that we have a choice and that we have some power in any circumstance. And it's one of the most important lessons we can learn is to stop generating anger through feeling like we have no choice.
Yeah, and assertiveness.
One of the important things that I would say to people here is being a victim and having that mentality takes a toll on every area of your life. But you need to see it this way. Energy follows thought. So if you're thinking like a victim, only bad things happen to me, that's going to create a negative energy in your body. But if you're thinking like a person in charge of his or her life, it's a great day today. I'm looking forward to having lunch with my friend. You're going to feel much different.
I think that's so essential. We can choose how we think about our circumstances. It seems so simple, but it's so important, and it really does shift you out of that anger. And I think you brought up something very important. You brought it up before, too, this look at the benefits to your anger. For example, caretaking.
Right.
It's really, what are you getting out of acting like a victim?
You're getting caretaking. You don't have to take responsibility for anything. You can just remain unconscious, really.
Yeah, it's a strategy, and it's one that's effective in some ways, but in many ways, as you point out, it really messes up your life, as does another strategy you write about that comes out of, you believe, childhood wounds, passive aggressiveness. And you
right.
say this is a strategy children learn, you know, when they're taught that their anger is unacceptable, so it's resistance while appearing outwardly agreeable.
Exactly. They say yes when they mean no. And they feel powerless in situations, so they go along with the flow, you know, because they just feel so helpless and powerless.
But it's a snotty yes. It's somehow,
I didn't hear you.
Oh, it's a snotty yes. They're somehow, you know, they're knifing you a little as they say yes.
Yes. It's sarcastic. They're very critical and sarcastic people. And they pass it off as, well, this is my personality, you know. We've all heard people say, oh, I was just telling a joke when I said that. Well,
yeah, it sounds like
the arrow out of your heart.
Right. It sounds like what you said before about your behavior, how, you know, you would laugh because you thought that was your role. Somebody once said that, and you become driven into a pattern.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so your book, Mindful Anger, I'm talking with Dr. Andrea Brandt. Her book is Mindful Anger, A Pathway to Emotional Freedom. You talk about five steps to coming back into control, too. You call it mindfully releasing your anger. But this is basically about how to be able to have these conversations with people where you're talking like an articulate adult instead of like some, you know, enraged bull, where you're able to access your reason and slow things down. And so I'm going to read through the steps and then we'll talk about them. So the five steps are get your anger percolating, move your feelings out through writing, tell your story to another, find your new truth, and perform a release ceremony. So let's talk about these. Get your anger percolating. How does that help you to get to a better place anger-wise?
It gets you, if you're being mindful, you're feeling your anger, and it's like coffee percolates. It's just percolating. It's inside. You can do your job and be angry. You're not stuffing it. You're not dumping it. You're just feeling it inside. And that helps you release your anger, because the more you feel it, the longer you feel it, the more it goes, because feelings have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
And how does writing, moving your feelings out through writing, why is that helpful?
Well, and I don't mean on a computer. I mean with paper and pencil. It gets the energy out, and it gives you time to focus. it gets the emotional energy out of your body by writing, and it connects your mind with your hands and your body, and it's a powerful release.
Yeah, this is very important, this thing where you say, not on a computer.
Right.
There's been recent research on that. There's a book on learning called A Mind for Numbers by Dr. Barbara Oakley that's coming out, I think, in August. She'll be on the show. And she talks about that, how much better, like for note-taking, that you take the information in so much better when you use your hand to paper. And I think with this also, what you're talking about, writing down your feelings, that, you know, typically we experience our feelings in our brain. There's a cloud and there's a feeling in there. And if you when you put it on paper, it's all down there. You can't avoid it the same way, or just be distracted the same way you can if it's just floating around in your brain cloud.
Exactly.
So another one you say, this is very interesting, tell your story to another. You say being validated by others is a basic human need, but you also talk about this vis-a-vis group therapy and why this is helpful in helping people have a breakthrough.
Well, firstly, it's really helpful to feel truly heard. And then you hear that others have had similar shameful experiences and that you're not alone. And so it shifts the self-judgment to self-acceptance.
And now you talk about also telling it yourself a story to help you cope. So what do you mean by that?
Because when you can tell the story, you're not alone with all the details. Many years ago, the woman who wrote The Drama of the Gifted Child wrote a second book that was called For Your Own Good. And in it she said, not only was the trauma so disturbing for the child, but not being able to talk to someone about it. Walking around with all the feelings and all the thoughts all by yourself is very upsetting. So it's a way of coping when you can share it with someone who's hearing you.
And finally, you have perform a release ceremony, physically release your feelings. And I love this. I started out giving free advice in the street corner. And one of the things we used to suggest was, you know, people broke up, have a funeral for your relationship. And actually, it turns out the research stands behind this. It really does help. And you're talking about something similar. And it goes along with this research that shows that doing is a highly efficient way to get to being.
Yes. And taking action of some kind. You know?
Yeah, that's meaningful.
So if
very,
you
it's very
pick up a rock and throw a rock, that is very helpful. Just having the experience of throwing something, letting it go, holding a ball and letting it drop.
Yeah, these symbols, it's so amazing. It sounds so kind of, okay, that's simple. So you don't really have to have your friends all dressed in black, and there doesn't have to be a casket. It can be shoebox. It really, really, these rituals are very helpful. Now, we are almost out of time. I have been talking with Dr. Andrea Brandt. Her book is Mindful Anger, A Pathway to Emotional Freedom. It's very good. And the stuff on mindfulness is very well laid out in here. So for anybody that thinks, like, oh, my God, I can't meditate, it's really easy. She makes it simple. So I recommend getting the book for that. Do you have any final words of wisdom to leave us with?
Yes, I really think, excuse me, that people avoid mindfulness and being by themselves and getting up close and personal with their feelings because they're afraid of the discomfort. And I believe that people need to know that there is no change in our lives without discomfort.
I think that is so, so important. Dr. Andrea Brandt, thank you so much for being with us. Mindful Anger is her book, A Pathway to Emotional Freedom. That was a really illuminating show. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you so much, Amy, for having me. I really enjoyed talking to you.